From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. There's a lot of big news. Maybe in the later part of the show, we'll be talking about some of the what I consider a very dangerous phenomenon of anti-Asian hatred, which is being promoted by our national newspaper, Globe and Mail. But I believe Zafar is on the line. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I'm with you.
Hey, thank you. I wonder if you're with me on this subject. We have a problem of a really dangerous government, in my opinion, and I shouldn't say government, our media, with attitude towards Asians, specifically Chinese, but the wider community that's endangered by the kinds of front pages we have. But also, as you know, of course, you're in the authority, the Muslim community comes in for a lot of targeted attacks because of the hysteria.
Yes, this is one of those really sad and very dangerous situation that people of different ethnicities and backgrounds are targeted in this fashion. The latest victims, of course, are the Asian community. But as you pointed out, Muslims have been targeted for a very long time. The same attitude exists towards the Afro-Caribbean community and, you know, the black community in general. And it is extremely depressing because we don't need to go through these things after one group after another. I think these people in the media ought to grow up and realize their responsibility, that they're supposed to understand that Canada is a multicultural country,
yes.
That there are people of all backgrounds, ethnicities, etc., and that we should all be living in harmony and peace with each other rather than always trying to create divisions.
Mm-hmm.
But regrettably, as they say, you know, controversy sells. And so, unfortunately, some media outlets, not all, but some media outlets continue to play that very, very dangerous role, jeopardizing the lives of innocent people.
Yeah. The phenomena of the targeted group is like group of the month or this season. You know, apropos, and I won't labor the issue, but since we have, you're an authority on these matters, I want to bring to light this. You make the point about multiculturalism or multicultural society, and we're having this little moment of hysteria. I don't know how long it's going to last, but involving China. And the subject, they have this label where the way they discuss it, they say in the media and even the government and the other parties, foreign interference, they worry about it. And then they say, well, how do we know and how bad is it? And they say, well, we've been consulting our allies in the organization called Five Eyes. So let's see, that would be a country called Australia. And a country called New Zealand, a country called the United Kingdom, a country called the United States, and then us.
Yes.
Isn't that foreign interference?
exactly.
And my understanding is, and when I read about them, when they're patting themselves on the back, is that they say they share intelligence.
Yes.
And one of the little games they like to play is that they will say, well, you know, country X, New Zealand, say, has laws prohibiting investigation into certain parts of people's lives, so they can ask Australia to look into that.
Yes.
And then pass it to the New Zealand guys. I don't see a lot of multiculturalism. They do. What I the identifying characteristics of Five Eyes is that they are white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and English-speaking.
Yes.
So when they say foreign, they actually seem to mean people from Africa, Asia, South America.
Yes.
That would be foreign, apparently, to them. Yes. Anyway, let's see.
Yes. Unfortunately, at the present time, both China and Russia are being targeted because the United States, for some reason, is addicted to wars and conflict. It simply cannot live in peace with the rest of the world. Jimmy Carter actually said that, you know, in America's 240-odd years of history, it has been at war for 227 years. And China hasn't been at war with anybody, and that's why China is able to build bullet trains and all this fantastic development that they are making. Mm. And the United States is basically lagging behind. America's infrastructure is crumbling. There are deep divisions inside the society. Its banks are collapsing now, as we hear about, you know, this Silicon Valley Bank and now this Signature Bank, et cetera, at the two ends. I mean, you know, America really needs to stop this constant warfare around the world and killing innocent people all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it is because of this very, very dangerous attitude that the United States has, and the policies that it pursues, and it forces its so-called allies to go along with it, has resulted in the latest sort of situation whereby we saw just a few days ago that China actually played an incredibly remarkable role in patching up differences between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And America was nowhere to be seen. America was just completely kept out of this whole
thing. The headline I saw said, blindsided.
Well, you know, it's something that I must say. I was expecting some kind of a meeting between Iran and Saudi officials, but I was anticipating that to occur in maybe Baghdad, because Iraq had, since April of 2021, hosted five meetings of Iranian officials. And prior to this announcement that came out of Beijing, it was announced, or there were reports, that perhaps even the foreign ministers of the two countries might meet. And so we were expecting that they would probably be meeting in Baghdad sometimes, and all of a sudden we had this absolutely incredible news coming out of Beijing on March the 10th that China has been able to facilitate these talks in utmost secrecy, and that the two countries have agreed to restore diplomatic relations and to work towards peace and security in the region. Mm-hmm. And I must say I'm very delighted by this, because not because Iran and Saudi Arabia have much in common in terms of their global outlooks, but the fact is that it is better for countries to be talking to each other rather than to be griping at each other and trying to undermine each other. Mm-hmm. Iran has a very, very fine record that in the last 250 years or so, it has not attacked a single country anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a remarkable record to have.
Makes the U.S. very suspicious of them.
Exactly.
And you haven't been at war anywhere. I mean, why should we talk to you?
Exactly. And so, in that sense, I think Iran has always called for, good neighborly relations with its neighbors. It has always talked about collective security in the region. And it has pointed out that whenever there are external powers that intrude into the region, they only instigate more conflict rather than serving the interests of the people. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm very glad that, China played this role. And it's also indicative that, China is now becoming more engaged, not only economically, but also diplomatically. And we can see the contrast between what the U.S. does and what China has done. Mm-hmm. And China not only wants to invest in other countries to help them to develop economically, but it is now also acting as a facilitator to tone down conflict and differences and to help countries to arrive at a mutually beneficial arrangements. And yes. In that sense, I think this agreement mm-hmm. that the Chinese brokered, which of course was over a period of 5 days, and incredibly, this was kept such a tight secret. I'm really, really impressed, because otherwise, people do get this information out.
Yes.
It just wasn't known. And the other factor in this equation is that a day before this announcement was made in Beijing regarding the agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the Saudi foreign minister was in Moscow meeting his Russian counterpart, Sergey Lavrov. And I saw the press releases from the Russian foreign ministry. There were actually cryptic hints in that, in which the Russian foreign minister said that we encourage resolving differences in the region through dialogue and understanding and so on, and et cetera. So there was obviously the Saudi foreign minister had briefed his Russian counterpart about what was going on. But the Americans were completely blindsided. They knew nothing of what was going on. And yeah. In the end, they obviously they couldn't do anything about it, so they had to admit that, well, we want tensions to be reduced and that, it is good that these issues can be resolved through dialogue.
Yeah. I want to go into details with you about what is contained in it, but before we do, I want to just point out this matter of why we're not properly informed here. We don't actually have a news service that just gives us the facts of the day. And here we are. It's been several days now, three or four days since the agreement. And the Toronto Star on page 8 has one paragraph. And the paragraph is titled, Tehran touts deal with Saudis. And then there's it has a one-paragraph story in which, I may as well read it. Iran's mission to the United Nations says a breakthrough agreement with Saudi Arabia restoring bilateral relations will help bring a political settlement to Yemen's years-long war. Iran state media reported on Sunday. Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed Friday to reestablish diplomatic relations and reopen their embassies after 7 years of tensions that brought the two global regional powerhouses to the brink of conflict and fueled tension across the region. End of story.
Yeah.
They don't mention where this agreement was struck.
Correct.
And they don't mention China.
Yeah.
And you say, let me just pose a possible theory. Allegedly, we are isolating and putting a halt to Chinese, whatever it is. And it doesn't sound like we are, but how about that for coverage for the Canadian public? No wonder we have problems.
Exactly, because this media keeps the people in the dark, in total ignorance of the reality. They don't mention the fact that Iran has always been anxious to maintain good neighborly relations. As I had mentioned earlier, that they have never attacked any country in the last 250 years. And the fact that it is China rather than the United States that was involved in it, whereas previously the U.S. considered that region, the West Asian region, as its personal domain, and that it, even when Biden had visited Saudi Arabia last July, there he had said that, we will remain engaged with the region. We are not going to allow China or other powers to interfere in the region, etc. But it is basically the United States that has been interfering in that region for decades. And so after eight decades, America has essentially been thrown out of the region. And this had started much earlier, but I think this is another notch in this campaign to remove America's malign influence, mm-hmm. because that only promotes differences, that only promotes conflict. And of course, the Americans do it deliberately, because if there is conflict, then they can sell more weapons. Mm-hmm. But you know, in the Star story that you just read, Iran had at no stage threatened Saudi Arabia with war, and so this notion that somehow it was going to erupt into war is completely off base.
Yes.
As I mentioned, Iran is not a belligerent country. It will always defend its interests, but it will not attack anybody. And mm-hmm. so in that sense, their reading of the situation is completely wrong, number mm-hmm. one. Secondly, as you rightly pointed out, they didn't even mention that agreement was signed, brokered by China, because mm-hmm. they can't bring themselves up to the fact that China can play a conciliatory role in bringing countries together.
Yeah, this comes after everyone was laughing when China said, well, we could mediate the Ukraine matter.
Exactly.
And they put forward, by the way, I notice how everybody ignores the important details. They had a 12-point plan.
Yes.
You can like it or not like it, but they said this is how it could be done. And everyone said, who did that? Well, only a couple of weeks later, they show that they can broker agreements, and they know how to do it, apparently.
Yes.
Partly it is by not saying you have to have one of our air bases, and we'll appoint all your governors, which is the American way. But I want to raise a name here. And apropos of how these talks came off, my memory is that the General Soleimani, I think he was a general.
Yes.
Was assassinated on the orders of Donald Trump.
Yes.
Murdered, along with other Iraqi commanders, people who were, they were leading organizations that were fighting ISIS in Iraq, the two of them. They were murdered at the airport in Baghdad.
Yes.
And the report was that Soleimani was there to talk with Saudi representatives about reestablishing relations. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, he was carrying a very important message from the leadership in Iran. Although he was a general and a commander of the Quds force in Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps, but he was on a diplomatic mission. And he was to be received by the Iraqi prime minister during the day. When he arrived in Baghdad just past midnight of January the 3rd, 2020, the Americans, on the orders of Donald Trump, they fired missiles at their vehicle as he came out of the airport, and that vehicle, of course, was destroyed. So not only General Soleimani, but Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was the deputy commander of the Iraqi militia forces, as well as a number of other of their colleagues, nine of them altogether were murdered in that vehicle. And this was a war crime because Americans violated Iraq's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, and the fact that General Soleimani was on a diplomatic mission. In fact, Agnes Callamard, who was the UN Special Rapporteur for extrajudicial killings at that time, she pointed out that this was a war crime and that American officials who are responsible for this should be held to account. So to round up the circle, you mentioned that it was General Soleimani who was carrying that message in order for the negotiations to continue or the negotiations to progress, because Iraq then started to host the Iranian and Saudi officials in Baghdad starting from April 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that the Americans, Donald Trump and his military commanders, etc., carried out this crime on Iraqi soil. And, of course, the Iranians have said that they will avenge this killing. They're not going to forget it, nor forgive it, because General Soleimani was a very, very important figure in the Iranian administration, and he was deeply respected, he's deeply revered, and I think that score has to be settled. But, you know, unfortunately, as we see, you know, the Americans act as outlaws, and then they just sort of, you know, walk away from it and say, well...
There are these, that amazing conduct, the hubris, I guess we call it, destroying the Nord Stream pipeline, which, I mean, who else did it? And then Donald Trump ordering the arrest of a Chinese businesswoman and Canada having to do it.
Yes.
Which destroyed the business here, and destroyed relations. We're living in the aftershock of the orders. And it was out of the blue. Canadians wake up and they said, oh, yeah, well, we did that. And you say, why? I mean, she didn't commit a crime and isn't accused of any wrongdoing. She's a successful business. Her business is very vital part of, you know, Canadian technological scene. And so, nope. He says he wants her arrested. You got to arrest her.
Yes.
It's amazing. But they dine out on that kind of sense of their own power. Biden likes to put on his aviator glasses and say, nah, shoot it down. Yeah. It's peculiar behavior. But thank you for outlining that story of the death of Soleimani. And the fact is that, they were talking already. And it clearly, the Americans didn't want them talking.
Yes.
And when you mentioned how they, the expectation might have been that they would meet in Baghdad. But given that assassination, I don't see how they would go through with it. I think that they needed a secure place. A country that really has control over all of its facilities to say, you'll be safe here.
Yes, that's, I think, a very, very important point that you make, because obviously Baghdad is still not secure. The Americans still have a military presence in Iraq, ostensibly to be fighting Daesh or ISIS terrorists, but in fact they support those terrorists. They are doing it precisely in Syria right now, where, you know, a few last week or so, the U.S. Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, was in Syria illegally, and you know, in the area where these ISIS terrorists are operating. And so you see that General Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis of the Iraqi militia commander, they were involved in fighting against ISIS terrorists and eliminating them from Iraq by the year 2017.
Yeah, there was even a moment, wasn't there, when U.S. personnel and Soleimani were walking alongside each other in this common effort.
I think probably that's true. But I think then these people were moved from there to Syria as well as to Afghanistan by the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans are actually, on the one hand, they claim that they are fighting against ISIS terrorists. But on the other hand, they are actually financing them. They are providing them shelter. They are providing them weapons in order to destabilize that region.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the kind of incredible, hypocritical attitude that the Americans have, that they are the ones that are supporting terrorists, and then they accuse others of supporting terrorism and, you know, indulging in violence, etc.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International, or just write Zafar Bengash, and you'll find about all the things Zafar does and can find his writings. I want to make sure, well, I guess I should go to this point. The Cradle, which seemed to me a wonderful publication, I'd like your thoughts about that, and Sharmeen Arwani and others, they're commenting on this, and they've listed the agreement. It seems very substantial. What parts of this agreement stand out for you? I know there's the matter of Yemen, which is probably at the bottom of the hardest nut to crack, actually, is the Yemen matter.
Yes.
But diplomatic relations, of course, but also closer relations and not alignment, but I would anticipate things might change in the area where they're having problems with Turkey, the Kurds, and Iraq, et cetera. Are they going to be impacted, do you think, by this agreement?
Well, I think it definitely is going to have a positive influence. I think with respect to this agreement, what is significant about it is that both Iran and Saudi Arabia are considered to be regional powerhouses. Iran, of course, in terms of its military might, its diplomatic strength, and strategically important position, whereas Saudi Arabia is a financial powerhouse. And also, I was actually quite struck by the fact that an agreement that had been signed between Iran and Saudi Arabia back in April of 2001, it was a security pact. And the Saudi interior minister had gone to Tehran to sign this agreement. But regrettably, the Saudis did not live up to their side of the bargain, and that remained dormant. So in this agreement, they mentioned that that security pact would be revived and that both countries would work on it to maintain security and stability in the region. That's the first thing. Of course, there was, you know, as you mentioned, the Saudis are anxious to find a face-saving formula for exiting from Yemen. Now, the Iranians, the foreign ministry, the day after this agreement was announced in Beijing, the Iranian foreign ministry announced that this agreement will facilitate a resolution of the Yemeni conflict with all parties involved in it. And a similar statement was issued in Moscow by the Russian foreign ministry, quoting Russian foreign minister Mr. Lavrov, that he had also said that we look forward to the resolution of the Yemeni conflict with all parties involved. So I think there appears to be a consensus building up that, contrary to what the Saudis were doing earlier on, that they were insisting that only their puppets are going to be in power in Yemen, that has now been, the Saudis have agreed to put that aside, and they are willing to work with all parties in Yemen, which obviously includes and must include the Ansarullah, who are the primary sort of, you know, force in Yemen today. And so in that sense, I personally feel that we can probably look forward to the resolution of the Yemeni conflict following this agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. There is one other factor that I want to mention, and that is that Iran had insisted that Saudi Arabia stop its funding of this vile propaganda outlet.
Oh, boy. I'm glad you raised that. Go ahead, please.
Operating from London. It is called Iran International, which is basically financed by the Saudis. So at the end of last month, it was announced that this propaganda outlet has stopped functioning from London, and all of their staff have moved to the United States. No doubt, the Americans are going to be financing it, but the Saudis have pulled out of it. And I think that also...
If I could just interrupt, I hadn't realized that. So prior to this meeting in Beijing,
yes,
they had already shifted the personnel.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
The signs, there was a straw in the wind, as it were.
Yes, absolutely, yes. So in other words, like, you know, there was obviously give and take on both sides, mm-hmm. but for Iran, this was important because this outlet, Iran International, was spewing hatred against Iran, spreading lies, and the Americans were also involved in it. But the Saudis realized that if they want to, you know, survive in the region, if they want to have peace and security, then they'll have to stop these nonsensical sort of, you know, activities. And I'm glad that they did mm-hmm. about 10, 12 days ago, that this station was shut down in London and all the staff moved to the United States.
It's interesting about what is behind this, but when I asked, I noticed that we had President Erdogan, who was a good friend of the West, or at least he was a solid NATO guy, and but then there was somebody tried to overthrow him, and it turned out that the leadership of the group was in the United States.
Yes.
And he decided he'd take a few steps back. And similar thing has happened with the Crown Prince, right? Is that his name? They call him, what do they call it, this gentleman who runs Saudi Arabia?
Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He seems to realize that, you know, that's a two-edged sword, that business of running an anti-Iranian network. And those, the very people doing that could actually harm him.
Yes. Exactly. I think it's he seems to be gradually realizing, and this is not just with Iran, but it's also with Syria, with Qatar that he had blockaded back in 2017, and then at the beginning of 2021 he made up with the Emir of Qatar, and also with Iraq, he visited Baghdad and, you know, made up with them. So it seems to me that he has realized now that he cannot continue on this disruptive campaign, and that there will be no blowback from that. And
yeah,
so I think that's a yeah. good sign.
They throw people away after they've used them up. You know, if you gauge like they did in Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden and all that, that they get you at a certain point when you provide the money, personnel, and then they integrate themselves with you. You realize they can get rid of you.
Yes.
If you say, well, no, I don't think we should do that, they say, well, you're retired.
That's right, yes. So, I mean, Hillary Clinton actually admitted during her testimony in the Senate back in October of 2012, she openly admitted that, you know, it was the United States that created Al-Qaeda. She didn't deny it. Like, you know, it was open admission.
Yes.
And the same thing with ISIS, that it's the Americans. There were, you know, photographs released back in 2013 when Senator John McCain, had illegally entered Syria. He was photographed with the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr
yes.
al-Baghdadi.
Yes.
And then later on, his office said, oh, that photograph was released by mistake.
Yeah.
Well, but they didn't deny that he was
so,
there. Who
yeah.
do you mean by me? Okay, by mistake.
So if there's no photograph, there was no meeting. and incidentally, now, of course, they agreed that they will not involve themselves with people who are fighting inside either, you know, if Saudi Arabia has internal enemies, Iran will not be engaged with that, and contrary. So that means that the famous organization with an army in Albania, are they the MEK?
Yes, MEK, yes, or MK.
They're going to be... U.S. is going to have to take over payment for that outfit.
That is correct, yes. But I think, you know,
that bank may fail.
Yes, in terms of, you know, Iran interfering in Saudi Arabia, I think Iran is very, very careful. It doesn't do things like that. It was the Saudis that were instigating trouble inside Iran, particularly in the western province of Khuzestan, which is Arabic-speaking, as well as in Balochistan, where the people are basically of Balochi origin. The Saudis were financing both groups, and I think as a consequence of this agreement, the Saudis have pledged that they would no longer do things like that. I hope that they can live up to their pledges.
That's going to be the test.
Exactly. That would be the test. And so we'll see what happens.
It's the old, I hear what you say, and I see what you do.
Yes.
But it strikes me that the step is so dramatic and so such a commitment that if it fails, it's going to be because of sabotage, heavy, heavy sabotage from London and Washington.
Yes, I think they will try their level best to make it fail, because this agreement is actually a slap in the face of the United States, as well as a major punch in the face of Israel, because Israel was trying to rope in all of these Arab regimes under its so-called Abraham Accords. But now we see that, you know, the prize that they were looking for of Saudi Arabia, that they'll be able to get Saudi Arabia along with them to fight against Iran, I think that has been stopped in its tracks. What Saudi Arabia does in terms of its relations with Israel, it's still not clear. It might still go ahead with, because there are indications that the Saudis and the Israelis are meeting secretly behind the doors, etc. In terms of any Saudi-Israeli alliance to attack Iran, that has been thrown out of the window as a consequence of this agreement. So I think that is another positive development.
Yes.
And given the terrible situation inside Israel, the divisions, among the Israelis in terms of protests against Netanyahu's decision to amend the
Yes, the Beijing news has not been happily received.
Yes, of course.
It's one more headache, and also it seems to expose the idea that the U.S. can snap its fingers and solve problems. Now they really have an internal headache,
yes.
And to have this added in, I'm seeing headlines of even the UAE. Saying they're not going to go forward with some agreements they were on the verge of developing with Israel.
Yes.
And this is like hours after this Beijing agreement.
Correct. So basically what it has done is on the external front, Israel has suffered a major setback in terms of not being able to use Saudi Arabia against Iran. And internally, of course, there are deep divisions in the Israeli society. I mean, those protests have been going on for weeks now against Netanyahu's regime. There are, in fact, even inside Israel, there are very, very senior officials, former Mossad heads, former prime ministers, former defense ministers, army chiefs, etc., all saying that Israel is heading towards a civil war. Because of these deep differences that have emerged in that society.
It's very dramatic.
Yes.
I noticed that the leader of Mossad gave permission to the civilian employees to demonstrate.
Yes.
I mean, it's turning into CSIS.
Yes, and also a number of Israeli reservists and military personnel have also come out in protest against this proposed change in the law in judiciary, which essentially is to gut the judiciary, to curtail the powers of the judges, because of the fact that Netanyahu has committed certain crimes, and he is afraid that if the trial is held, he would be found guilty, and therefore he would no longer be able to remain prime minister of Israel. So for his personal position, he is basically gutting the judicial law in the country, and that has aroused a lot of concern inside Israel.
Yeah. But it's suddenly a situation that never seemed to be changing at all, it always seemed to be repeat, is turning into turbulent and changing.
Yes.
Just to check the boxes here, I noticed that Hezbollah expressed satisfaction with this agreement, and that's Lebanon. And I remember 6-8 months ago, it looked like there was going to be a Saudi-backed effort to, and with Western concurrence, to try to take on Hezbollah. So I assume all that's changing.
Yes, it has. In fact, this is another area where we can look forward to some positive developments in Lebanon, because it has been the political process had been stymied because the Saudis were preventing the political process to move forward. So with this agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, I think the likelihood of a political settlement in Lebanon has become much brighter. Yes, for sure.
And that would also be positive for Syria.
Oh yes, of course. In fact, with the Syrian situation, last week there was a delegation of Arab parliamentarians that visited Syria. They had a meeting with Bashar al-Assad, and they all expressed their opinion that Syria should be brought in into the Arab League because it was one of the founding members of the Arab League, and that that the policy of trying to overthrow his government has completely failed, and that it's time that the Arab governments recognize that reality. And definitely that could not have occurred without the Saudis' blessings. Mm-hmm. At the same time, because of that terrible earthquake that occurred in Syria and Turkey, and you know, a number of Arab countries actually sent a lot of aid to Syria, not just to the areas under control of the ISIS terrorists, but also to areas under Syrian government control, particularly places like Aleppo and Latakia that were badly hit by the earthquake. So that's another indication that things are changing in the region, and that Saudi Arabia definitely has realized that it cannot continue to play that spoiler role. Things are not working according to its script, and that it has to come to terms with the reality. So these are positive changes. I think we can look forward to some sort of, you know, lessening of tensions in the region so that the people can live in peace, although unfortunately there will be no peace for the Palestinian people because of the policies mm-hmm. that Israel is pursuing. But elsewhere, I think there would be a lessening of
tensions. Might be some rethinking in that department. Perhaps Beijing should invite their leaders to come and talk. The only place I think that you could hope for any result, positive results. We're speaking to Zafar Benkash. By the way, Zafar, you're going to have a lot of interesting things to write about. You must be you have written a book about the Saud, the ruling family, and this is going to make an additional chapters.
Absolutely.
Or a new book.
Yes, exactly. In fact, a number of people have asked me that I should write a new book. I said, yes, of course. I'm already working on a book.
I think you should, actually. In light of this, if this holds up, you're going to have to reconfigure what the issues are there between the powers.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Well, thank you for the suggestion. I'll definitely think about it very carefully.
I'll be the deputy editor and call you and ask you whether you got a chapter done.
Excellent. That's wonderful.
It's Zafar Benkash. And now we have to come to the piece that is... Actually, we have left out of this puzzle, which is Pakistan.
Yes.
And how are they reacting? I mean, the shifting and moving. We have a thing called the Belt and Road. They're part of this, as far as I know. They have a popular leader who was removed, apparently, by the army, as interviews with you have indicated. They are... still in a confrontation situation. I understand there was a rally in Lahore, I guess, yesterday. There talk about arresting Imran Khan. And there's an expression they use, I want to ask you about that, called non-bailable arrest. In other words, if they take him, he can't be bailed. Is that it?
That is correct, yes. And in fact, you know, it's so incredible that...
what kind of law is that?
Yeah, you know, Imran Khan is by far the most popular leader Pakistan has ever had. His, he resonates with the people. They, literally tens of thousands of people have come out in Lahore to surround his house in the locality because the police were going to arrest him. And the masses will not allow the police to get anywhere near him. Mm-hmm. And so they cannot arrest him. And then, unfortunately, the military is sort of, is able to dictate to the judges as well. And that's what, you mentioned this non-bailable arrest, etc., that the judges are demanding that he be presented in court because of these scandalous allegations against him, completely nonsensical allegations against him. They have no basis in reality. But what they want to do is to tie him in these cases and to disqualify him so that he cannot run for elections. Although, according to the constitution of Pakistan, the two major provinces of Punjab and KPK, where Imran Khan's party was in power, both the assemblies were dissolved, and the constitution says that if the assemblies are dissolved, fresh elections have to be held within 90 days. And the other article of the constitution is that once elections are called, which they have been called, then the government or the caretaker government or no authority can impose what is referred to as Section 144. This is a colonial era article under which the government or the authorities prohibit the assembly of more than three people at a time. Now, if election campaigns are going on, how can you prevent people from getting together?
Did you say three people?
Three people, absolutely, that more than three people cannot get together. So if you're walking with your family and children,
that was
you could
a British, the British contribution.
Exactly. That's correct. And so this nonsensical, you know, policy is being pursued at the behest of the military, because the military knows that if Imran Khan were to come back to power, which he will if there were elections held in Pakistan, that he would go after them, of these corrupt generals that have become fat by, you know, taking millions of dollars out of the country. You know, it is so incredible that almost all of Pakistan's top generals or the army chiefs, when they retire, they retire abroad. They go outside the country and they have these vast estates. You know, I think you should do some investigation and you'd find out how many Pakistani military officers reside in Canada, especially in the Mississauga area. They're all millionaires. They own apartment blocks. And I wonder where on earth did they get this money from?
Well,
and they've been here only for the last...
Their being abroad sure makes the Pakistanis feel more secure, knowing the top generals have retired abroad.
Exactly. And so, you know, these generals know that if Imran Khan were to come to power, he's going to go after them. He says, I'm not going to give amnesty to anybody. Everybody should be held accountable. I'll start with myself, he says. I'll start with myself. And they keep on accusing him of having, you know, bank balances abroad. He said, please show me where I have any bank account abroad. I brought all my money from outside, which I had earned outside, and all my assets are in Pakistan. I have nothing outside the country. And yet, you know, there are politicians, there are generals, judges, they're all corrupt. They have stolen billions out of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. They brought Pakistan to the brink of economic collapse. And yet these generals continue to prevent the only solution to Pakistan's problem, that elections should be held so that the people can voice their opinion and a government established which would reflect the sentiments of the people. Mm-hmm. Before he was overthrown in April of 2022, Pakistan was doing quite well. Its economy had recovered. It was growing. Its economy was growing at 5 to 7% a year. Its GDP had grown. Its foreign exchange earnings had improved. Today, Pakistan has no foreign exchange earnings. It cannot import anything. It cannot import fuel. It cannot import food. It is like, you know, people are literally starving. Literally. Yes. I mean, you know, the poverty rate has gone up from 30% to 60% now in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's all because of this corrupt mafia that the army has imposed on the people. And they would not allow Imran Khan to come back to power. And they are refusing to hold elections in the country. So they are sort of doing all of these terrible, terrible things, frustrating the will of the people. But I'm glad that at least the people of Pakistan have come out in large numbers. They're standing with Imran Khan, and they have said that they are prepared to make any sacrifice that is needed. Mm-hmm. Last week, one of his workers was unfortunately beaten to death in public by the police. They just smashed his skull. They, you know, broke him, broke his bones. There was nothing that the poor man had done. He was just one of those, you know, ordinary supporters of Imran Khan, that he was murdered in cold blood. And the situation has become so bad that, you know, in October of last year, when there was an attack, assassination attempt on Imran Khan's life, according to the law, he can name anybody that he feels is behind this. So he named three persons responsible for this assassination attempt on him. The police would not register what is referred to as FIR, which is the first information report, because he was naming the current prime minister, the current interior minister, and one army general, that these three people were responsible for orchestrating this attack on me. So to this day, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan cannot get a case registered with the police as to who was responsible for that assassination attempt on him. So that's the kind of situation that we find ourselves in Pakistan.
Yeah. I have to ask you, it's Zafar Benkash, I would remind everybody. He, of course, is trying to fight back. He is being treated to intelligence games where they claim, make lies about him. Is there any media in that are on his side? How does that break down?
Yeah. Well, as far as the main media is concerned in Pakistan, the television stations, newspapers, etc., since they are under government control, none of these media outlets report anything that he says. But he has a massive following on the social media. There are a number of people that put out stories on Facebook and other platforms, and millions of people follow them. Millions, literally millions. I mean, whenever Imran Khan issues a statement, within a few hours, there have been millions of people that have actually read his statement. So in other words...
You know, that reminds me of Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
You remember when they had... Nobody in Iran, no paper carried his story, but he would say something and they would play the tapes.
Absolutely, exactly. That's the... Today, it's the you know, social media platform, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I mean, Imran Khan has, I don't know how many millions of followers on Twitter and on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so anytime he puts out any story or issues any statement, it instantly goes viral. The same situation exists with respect to these various social media platforms, these individuals that give out stories about Imran Khan's not only statements but the reality of Pakistan, and people just are you know, crazy about them. They just lap up those stories and information and pass them on. So that is how Imran Khan is able to communicate his message to the people.
The one detail that struck me as designer reporting for the West, they say he insulted a woman judge. And I thought, this seems to be what I would call a designer report.
Yes, yes. Well, basically what he had said was that, the statement that he had issued was that we want all the judges to act according to the law. And if they do not act according to the law, then we will hold them accountable. And that was the statement that was taken and said, he's threatening the judges. And this was a woman judge who had, done terrible.
And they knew
things.
That would play well in New York, Toronto,
exactly.
Paris, London.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, this is how they distort what he says. And then he even went, he said, look, to that particular judge, he went... to her, in front of her, in her court, he said, I never meant to insult you in any way. I had made a general statement that we expect our judges to give their judgments based on law, mm-hmm. not on what is dictated to them. And I do stand by the fact that anybody in Pakistan, whether it is a judge, a police officer, a bureaucrat, a politician, or a military general or anybody who violates the law, if we come to power, we will hold them accountable. Now, what's wrong with that?
Exactly.
I mean, these people should not be above the law, but somehow...
And it certainly had no gender point.
Exactly. There's nothing to do with gender.
But it was played here that way.
Absolutely. And in fact, I can tell you that, in Pakistan, Imran Khan is so popular with women and girls because he speaks about their rights as well. Some of his top ministers are high-powered women. They have, highly qualified, they have done excellent work, and he respects them a great deal. And so this whole nonsensical arguments and allegations that are made against him, that somehow he's opposed to women's rights or anything, is completely off base.
Yeah, and in these final moments, Zafar, you and I did interviews about this matter. it seems to me, it struck me that the moment that most of us here felt that he was going to be in danger of a coup was when he said that he had been visited by high-powered ministers from the UK, I think in the US, and they told him what the policy was going to be, and he answered, "Do you think we're slaves?"
Exactly.
"I'm not going to do that. I'm not a slave."
Yes.
And the moment he said, used that word, I thought, oh, my goodness, they're going to get him. Can yes. you tell us, what was that moment?
Yes. Well, in fact, you know, there was, he was being interviewed by a TV, I think it was a social media platform representative who asked him whether, if the United States were to ask Pakistan for military bases, because this was after the American retreat from Afghanistan. So he was asked whether Imran Khan as prime minister would allow American bases in Pakistan so that America can carry out drone attacks against the Taliban in Afghanistan. And his response was absolutely not. And that obviously was the thing that basically sealed his fate, because the Americans were looking for military bases. And regrettably, since Imran Khan's ouster, there have been drone attacks carried out inside Afghanistan, obviously from Pakistani territory. There is no other place in the world from where American drones or helicopters can fly into Afghanistan. They cannot possibly do it from China. They cannot do it from Central Asia, because Central Asian republics would have to be given the go-ahead by Russia. So that is out of the question. So the only, and the other country, of course, is Iran. Obviously, no American drone or anything can fly over Iran. So the only country that is left in the region is Pakistan. And so the current rulers in Pakistan and the military have allowed Americans to carry out drone strikes against Afghanistan, which is in violation of international law. And regrettably, Imran Khan had to pay a price for that, because he refused to allow the Americans to do that. And even earlier, he had said that we are no longer going to act as America's hired guns.
Yes.
He said, if America wants peace, we are going to be partners in peace. But if they want to wage war, we'll have nothing to do with it, because we know that war has cost us tremendously. I mean, you know, let me tell you, in Pakistan, because of America's so-called war on terror, more than 70,000 people have been killed. 70,000. And that includes, you know, military personnel as well as civilians.
That's
totally
too much.
Innocent people.
Yeah.
Pakistan has lost something like $150 to $170 billion as a result of America's so-called war on terror.
Yeah.
So, you know, Pakistan has suffered tremendously, and that's why Imran Khan said, we wish to have nothing to do with it anymore.
Yeah. Well, we have to close there. Zafar, has been an education. We
Thank
do
you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
my
much.
Pleasure. Thank
this
you.
This is the Tater Report at the CIUT, and we got a little music coming up.